Well, welcome. My name is Rick Myers. To give you a little bit of background on what we're going to do, one of the things that's happened now is that we, in the fall, have all the people who are going to be keynoters come in and a couple of other people and have about a day to a day and a half retreat where we talk about what's going to happen, the book, and Ron Cox this year. There's always a person called the expositor. And since the book was James's year, Ron was working on that. But James is arguably the book in the New Testament that has the most affinity with wisdom literature. And so one of the things they had me do was talk with the ministers who were going to be presenting about wisdom literature in the Old Testament, the dynamics and everything. So I'm essentially going to do for you today what I did for Ken and kind of walk you through that. A lot of this may be very familiar to it. Some may be less familiar because I'm going to talk a little bit about what we know about wisdom in the ancient Near East and try to draw some analogies. But let's go through some kind of basic stuff. When you think about, in the Old Testament, you think about key figures, especially leader-type figures, and everyone's familiar with the king. We know where kings belong. We're familiar with priests. We know where priests belong. So if you want to find the king, you go to the palace. You want to find a priest, you go to the temple. Prophets are a little tougher. Prophets, often, if you want to find a prophet, you go to the city square. They tend to be in the marketplace, or they could be. But then the sage, or the wise person, the question is, where would you have found sages? And I want to come back to that, because that's really a fairly interesting dynamic. We know virtually nothing about education in ancient Israel. We don't know much at all until we get close to the period of Jesus. By about 100 to 200 B.C., we start knowing a bit, and we know quite a bit about education in the period of Jesus and the New Testament period, but we're really interested in what education might have looked like. Was it formal, informal? So I want to come back and talk about that in a few minutes and why that's of some significance. When you think about wisdom in ancient Israel, and you think about different persons, one person, interestingly, that has often been cited as a sage or a wise figure early on is Joseph. And that will hopefully make sense by the time we get to this. If you remember the story of Joseph, Joseph starts out really as a spoiled brat. And early on, I mean, one could say a lot of Joseph's problems with his brothers are self-inflicted. I mean, think about family dynamics. If you sit around the dinner table and tell, you know, your siblings that you're having dreams and clearly you're the most important child in the family, you know, that's going to create some interesting moments. And then if you say that not only are you more important than your siblings, you're more important than your mother and father, it creates a dynamic. And so you just see that playing. But there's this key moment where when Joseph goes into Egypt, you see a pretty transformational or a big change in Joseph. And in many ways, how he behaves when he's in Egypt is pretty significant. Now, as a side note, one of the ways you know how Joseph's lot is going, this is simply a footnote, is there are several different ways, but one of the more interesting ones is you typically know how Joseph is doing based on whether he's in a pit or out of a pit. So when he goes into the pit, you know, things are bad. And in fact, the prison for Joseph is referred to as the pit. The other way you know about Joseph is what kind of clothing. Okay? So he's in trouble when his stuff gets ripped. Remember, the brothers shred the special robe. Potiphar's wife shreds the robe. But you know things are going well when the king of Egypt gives Joseph a special robe. And so that's one of the ways you can kind of tell how things are going with Joseph. But we'll come back and talk about what a sage and how a sage works. Solomon, for many, would probably be the most famous or the person who's associated with wisdom, and so we'll think about him a little bit. This is actually an inscription. If you've never seen if you know biblical Hebrew and what it looks like, this is pre-biblical Hebrew, so that's Solomon Shalom in Hebrew, in the earlier script. And then Daniel. Daniel is considered one of the sages in ancient Israel. Terminology. So here's one of the big deals right out of the box. The term in Hebrew for wisdom or to be wise, the noun is chokmah, the adjective is chakam. Hebrew is guttural, so you have to talk out of the bottom of your throat. The reason this is significant is originally what this word means is to have a skill. A person who is a hakam or who has chokmah has a skill. Okay? So for example, in the book of Exodus, you have masons, you have carpenters, you have all these different people who are working on the tabernacle, and they are referred to as having a hakam. Okay? You're a hakam in bricklaying, or you're a hakam. You have that skill. Ultimately, then, this word comes to mean one who is skilled in living. Okay? So wisdom is not simply about knowledge. Wisdom is about applied knowledge. It's how you put it into practice. It's more behavior than simply what you know. In other words, I often tell students the difference between wisdom and intelligence is intelligence is just sort of brain power. It's your IQ. Okay? Wisdom is applying that or manifesting it in a particular type of behavior. And so that becomes very, very significant. You can tell a sage or a wise person by how he or she behaves. Okay? So, in ancient Israel, if you know the book of Proverbs divides unevenly into two sections, Proverbs 1 to 9 and 10 to 30. The first nine chapters, though, the bookends, you know what the driving theme is. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. It's right at the outset in chapter 1, and it bookends in chapter 9. So that's the key theme. Now, as a side note, fear in ancient Israel, the term here does not mean to be afraid of. This is not the word for being scared or afraid. This is the word that often gets translated in the context of reverence or awesomeness, okay? So to fear the Lord does not mean to be afraid of God. It means to hold God in awe, to hold God in reverence. Now, one of the reasons that's of some significance, especially for us today, is if you take the modern perception and flip it on its head, you have an understanding of ancient Israel. What I mean by that is this. My sense would be, in the modern world, I've lived my whole life in the academy, okay? So I can almost guarantee you, in the academy, the assumption is, if you are a person of faith, you cannot be intellectually rigorous, because to be a believer means you have taken one step away from true intellectual rigor, okay? That you've sort of sold out in a key component. In ancient Israel, it is the opposite. Turn it on its head. The idea is you cannot be truly intellectual if you do not manifest the fear of the Lord or you're not a believer. Okay? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's put it in more contemporary language. If you remember, this is a kind of a neat line. Anselm had that famous line about, you know, the essence of his life was faith seeking understanding. I love that line, that faith seeking understanding, that's what we're about. Well, wisdom, if you understand fear in the right way, the reverence or belief in God, wisdom is fear seeking understanding. Okay, so here's a little bit better quote. Fundamentally, wisdom is about making sense of God, the self, and the world, and acting accordingly. So it's not simply knowledge, it's applied knowledge. Wisdom is the art of living fully, acting justly, and venturing forth reverently. If you're familiar with Micah 6:8, you know, what does God require of you? He's paraphrasing that. So let's talk about the wisdom literature. In the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, you have the following books. You have Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, or in Hebrew it's known as Kohelet. And then if you come from a Catholic tradition, you also have the book of Sirach or Ben Sirach. And you also have the Wisdom of Solomon. Now, one of the things we're going to talk about is how you can spot wisdom or characteristics. A number of scholars are absolutely convinced that some of the materials in the Old Testament, though, are also reflective of a wisdom influence. If you think about it, I mean, you know, we have to do something for a living, people like me. So one of the things we do is we sit around and try to think about who wrote this material. Okay? So, it's not hard to figure out that when you're reading Leviticus, a priest or priests probably wrote that. I mean, they've got lots of technical priestly language, right? And it's also not always hard to figure out materials that have been approved by the king. You know, kings tend to have material come out that's somewhat sympathetic to them, although Israel's a bit of a ringer in that. The kings let stuff that's a little more negative get out. It's often not so hard to tell what prophets have written. The question is, can you tell material that was written by the sages, by the wise people? And so think about Genesis 1 through 11. What are some of the themes? I mean, the very right out of the box, right? You have the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And you have the tree of life. If you remember in Proverbs 3 says wisdom is a tree of life. Okay? But you have all these things about Babel. Let's make a name for ourselves. All these kinds of things that typically we could have associated with wisdom. Joseph is very much this way. At one time, there were a number of scholars who were convinced one of the functions of the Joseph narrative was to show young people how to live. The second half of Joseph, not the first half. That Joseph was really a manifestation in character. Joseph does the right thing for the right reason, and people around him are benefited because of that. The succession narrative, this one, if you're not familiar, this is technical language, but this is the block of material. You remember when David is getting quite old, and the question is, who will succeed David? It's that material leading up to Solomon is called succession narrative, because the theme is about who will succeed. There are a lot of wisdom themes in that. And then in the prophetic literature, there's some question. You can tell in the book of Amos, he very well may have been educated by the wise. Interestingly, we'll come back in just a second, but apparently, if you don't carry this stuff probably, but Amos grew up in a little town south of Jerusalem called Tekoa. And if you remember the narrative about David, the wise woman or wise women of Tekoa come and instruct David. And so there are two or three references in the Old Testament. It's pretty clear Tekoa must have had sages, and interestingly, the sages were female. And so one of the questions is, can you read the book of Amos and see the influence of wisdom? And I think the answer to that is yes. He uses certain literary forms, and he talks in certain ways, and it's like, okay, he was influenced by them. Isaiah, you also have the same thing there. Habakkuk has influences. Jonah does. Then, of course, you have Daniel. Daniel, one aspect of the wisdom tradition that's a little different is not only dreams, but interpreting dreams. Remember in Joseph, one of the interesting dynamics is in the first half of his life, when things don't go well, Joseph is the dreamer. In the second half, when things go really well, Joseph interprets dreams. And Daniel has dreams and also interprets dreams. And interestingly, when he does that, he attributes it to God. And you get a lot of wisdom language in Daniel. And then you have Esther. Some would argue, again, there are themes and motifs there. Some would argue that Esther is a good example of what wisdom looks like, again, in female form. Okay, let's talk. This is going to probably be a little more significant. There are two types of wisdom literature in ancient Israel and in the ancient Near East. What you know as the Middle East in my world is called the ancient Near East. And this runs across. You can tell what type of material you're in by the very form it comes in. Okay? So, one type of wisdom literature is what we call the positive. It comes in forms of it's the positive or pragmatic, and it comes in the forms of proverbs, maxims, pithy sayings, you know, catchy kind of stuff. Okay, a stitch in time saves nine, a rolling stone gathers no moss, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Now, I mention that because you also can always tell, or frequently can tell, the social context of a proverb, right? Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. That clearly reflects an agrarian setting. That does not reflect our world, right? The two wealthiest groups I know, well, I mean, if you take out the corporate world, but entertainers and professional athletes are not early to bed, early to rise making them healthy, wealthy, and wise. I mean, they stay up late, and they get up late, and they make a fortune, right? So it reflects a certain context. Now, But that's Proverbs, and this material really traffics in the notion, the idea that there is a right and a wrong way to do things, to speak, to live. And you get a lot of language like the two ways. There's a right way to take and a wrong way to take. And the assumption or presumption is that when you act the right way, live the right way, talk the right way, behave the right way, your life will go right. And the examples of that we have in the Old Testament are the book of Proverbs, and then, again, if you have the expanded canon, Sirach. Now, that works pretty well. Proverbs does reflect it. It's a little more complicated than that, but that works pretty well. But let's suppose you live the right way, do the right things, behave in the right way, and your life does not turn out right. How do you deal with that? The other type of wisdom literature we have is what's called the negative or the reflective. And the negative or the reflective, in contrast to proverbs and maxims of that, always comes in the form of a monologue or a dialogue. Okay? And so the two examples we have of that are Job and Ecclesiastes. Job is a dialogue. Lots of people are familiar with the prologue and the epilogue, where Job loses everything and is hanging pretty tough, and then you jump over to chapter 42 and he gets back double everything he lost. But if you read the 40 chapters in between, Job in dialogue form, in conversation with his friends, essentially, you name it, he blames it on God. Ultimately, when Job begins to air it out, if you know that material, he will tell God, or he will suggest that God is a tyrant, he's mean, he's capricious, he has no sense of justice. And not only has he messed up, when Job really begins to, I mean, remember, you're sitting on an ash heap in tremendous pain. You've lost everything. What else do you have to lose? When Job really airs it out, he basically says, and if you've got my life this messed up, I think you probably got the whole universe messed up. Which is a kind of nice setup, because when God comes, you have to kind of know, again, certain forms. God, when he comes, has a smile on his face, okay? And basically says to Job, you want to run the universe, have at it. And Job decides it may be a little more complicated than that. But Job is then, you know, it's a dialogue, right? Struggling with what happens when it looks like you're living your life the right way and your life does not turn out the right way. Ecclesiastes or Kohelet is a soliloquy, it's a monologue. And so, again, you know, Kohelet is one of those fascinating books where he's looking for the meaning, the ultimate meaning in life, and cannot find it. And again, if you remember that, what is it that brings ultimate meaning in life? I found for years, it was real fascinating, college students, for a lot of them, this is their favorite book, because it grapples with really tough issues out loud. So Kohelet, if you remember, looks for it in work. He tries being a workaholic, that goes nowhere. He tries pleasure. This is not hedonism, like, you know, Hugh Hefner type pleasure. This is pleasure, the absence of pain. He tries all sorts of different things, and ultimately, the hump that Kohelet cannot get over is death. The challenge he has is death cancels everything. That's the one he can't quite figure out. Okay? But again, it's a soliloquy. It's grappling with the ultimate meaning in life when life doesn't look like... Again, one of the things Kohelet says is, which is very, very radical, is the world is not straight. The world is crooked. And he's trying to figure out why the world is crooked. Okay, so let's do just fun things. One of the things I want to push here in a second, and you'll see it, is there are some really neat studies that have come out in the past 10 or 15 years that have argued that proverbs or proverbial type material are very significant in non-literate cultures. If you really want to know the values and what a society holds is really important, look at the Proverbs, because that will tell you really where they are. The argument is that's especially significant in non-literate cultures, of which Israel would have been that. By non-literate, I don't mean that, you know, there wasn't reading and writing. It's the overwhelming bulk of people did not read and write, right? Okay. In literate cultures, it becomes a little less so, and the argument now is Proverbs have a real comeback in post-literate cultures, and many are arguing we are in a post-literate culture. Okay? Now, So the question is, where would you find proverbs in a post-literate culture? You'd find them in bumper stickers or on t-shirts or whatever, right? And so that's where I want to go with you in just a second. But let's look at some. Again, what makes a proverb really work or stick is that it's got to have, you know, some kind of brevity, wit, cleverness, or whatever. So we'll just run through a few. So here's one from Africa. Again, they often have plays on words. When the going gets tough, the tough goes shopping. You know, you have that kind of line. Speak softly, wear a loud shirt. This is from the 60s. The grass is always greener on the other side of the border. People in this audience get that. Students, they don't. They just look at that and it's kind of like, really? Personal favorite here, you know. Students like this last one, especially on test day. Again, often proverbs have a little bit of cynicism to them. Now, let me try this though. Again, let's think about our society. Some of these are older, but they will work. You know, they work. They've been around for a while. So, the question is our society truly materialistic? Well, think about one of the lines we have. Everybody has his price, right? Or ethical relativism. Different strokes for different folks. You don't hear that as much anymore, but you know, that was kind of a line, right? Or individualism. Second place is first place loser. Jerry Seinfeld has a whole spiel on there's nothing worse than winning the silver medal in the Olympics, right? It's kind of a fascinating notion that you're second best in the world and you're the poor schmuck that's the loser, you know. Well, okay. Prejudice. So if you look at a bunch of these again, visual empiricism. We live in a society. This has huge implications for people of faith. That the only thing that's truly real is anything that you can empirically verify. Yeah, it again shows the values of our society. Science kind of dominates the landscape. Seeing is believing. What you see is what you get. Pluralism, whatever turns you on. Again, you know, think about the virtues of today. Tolerance, which is not too far from apathy, maybe. Money's the measure of all worth. Money talks. Money makes the world go round. Remember several years ago, the old E.F. Hutton commercials? You know, E.F. Hutton speaks and everything went silent. I mean, you have those variations today. And then this notion that there are no limits. You know, you can just, the sky's the limit, this kind of thing. Again, though, it has an impact in our world, right? Think about the amount of time that some like to put the faith or Christianity into a bumper sticker. This was the famous, you know, the Robert Schuller thing, God helps those who help themselves. I have no biblical passage to justify that. This one I love. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. I tell people, I've never had the courage to do this, but I often want to walk up to someone who has that on their bumper sticker and say, you really don't believe that. I've never met anyone who actually believes this. So if you do, you cannot believe this and have a bumper, right? Because the Bible said, go sell everything you have, give to the poor, and come follow me. How do you have a bumper, right? You haven't sold everything you have. I mean, so we immediately start figuring out how, yeah, he said it, but he didn't say it to me. I mean, that's the catch here, right? If it's going to be, it's up to me. Again, this very much, you know, Robert Schuller, Norman Vincent Peale. Remember the old No Fear t-shirts? They really said a lot about our society, right? Fear, just another four-letter word. I don't come here to play. I come here to win. There's no next time, no second chance, no timeout. This is a person who really does not have a good handle on reality. Know your limits and break them. And this one is really, you know, these are people who are out of touch with reality, right? I've never lost. I've just been a little behind when time ran out. Okay, so let's talk a little bit, and then we'll look at some of the materials. Here's the part that that I think is one of the most fascinating dynamics. Again, One of the real questions is, if you lived in ancient Israel, where would you find wisdom? And one real strong possibility would be you find it in the home. Okay? So you find it in the family or the clan, as in the larger family, not as in Ku Klux. You don't find it there. Really, it's the idea that, think about, you know, I mean, when you grew up, who told you stuff like a stitch in time saves nine, or, you know, pretty is pretty does, or, you know, beauty skin deep, ugly goes clear to the bone. I mean, you know, think of the things that parents tend to say that, or grandparents, right? So you could have learned wisdom or this kind of stuff from the extended family. But one that's, I think, even more interesting is whether there's any aspect of wisdom coming in some kind of educational, more formal educational system. Here's the idea, or the backdrop for this. We know, again, as I said earlier, we know virtually nothing about wisdom in ancient Israel or about the about the educational system. We don't know if they had schools, what those look like. So I'm going to start putting a bunch of things together. When you don't know anything, you just start speculating and having fun, okay? We know a ton about what education was like in Egypt and in Mesopotamia. But that's where I'll end up today. The short version on this is that in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, young boys, primarily, but not always, were brought to the court between 8 and 12, especially in Egypt, and they were educated. And they were educated for government positions domestically, but the best of them were also educated so that they could engage in international diplomacy. The Egyptians really, in my mind, had it right. Their thinking was, if you can send these people out highly educated who know more about the culture they're going to than the locals, you've got a leg up. And so these young men were brought to the court, and they were taught everything. You know, I mean, they not only learned to read and write, but typically they were bilingual, if not trilingual, because the argument was you negotiate best in the language of the home country. They were taught math, because if you're going to negotiate, you need to be able to do math on the fly. So, you know, you pull into the court at Byblos or whatever, you've been on a boat for 3 weeks, and you've got to figure out, you know, the cotton and the linen that you're bringing, what's its value in relationship to the grain and those kinds of things you're wanting to buy, or the wine or whatever, okay? So they're taught math, they're taught lots of high-end things. The other things they're taught, though, are what we might call etiquette, okay? And to know how to behave. So let's try a couple. You've been on a boat, you know, on a ship for 3 weeks, all you've eaten is hardtack, you pull into Byblos. The first thing that happens is the prince of the city invites you to a royal banquet. You sit down. You've had nothing but terrible food the whole time, and this food is phenomenal. It's spread in front of you. You wolf it down, and they offer you seconds. Do you take seconds or not? This is the prince offering you seconds. We get one yes. We get a no. Okay? The answer, you could go either way. The answer in Egypt is no. And the reason for no is because the king or the prince is testing to see what kind of self-control you have. And if you go for seconds, they know you do not have that much self-control. In every really tough negotiation, they simply need to stick with it and wait you out in the cave. So the argument is, you know, eat one round, and if you're starving to death, stop at McDonald's on the way back to the ship or do something like that. But again, it shows all this kind of stuff. Now, where this becomes really interesting is the two things, because these are young guys that are being sent out, the two things that we're seeing as the quickest way to self-destruct behaviorally, remember, wisdom is about behavior, would be inappropriate speech, inappropriate ethical or sexual behavior. And so there is a lot in this material about self-control with speech. In fact, in Egypt, the wise person is often referred to as the silent person. And the person who cannot control his or her emotions is called the hothead. It's really where we get it. It's from Egypt. Okay? Now, the issue is, of what significance is that for us? Again, we know nothing about education in Israel. We know, though, that Solomon, when he became king, was more impacted by his neighbors than any, well, there weren't that many, but than virtually anyone. Solomon had all these diplomatic wives, and one of his favorite wives was the princess from Egypt. And you can make a pretty good case that Solomon may have implemented an educational system in Israel somewhat akin to what you have in ancient Egypt. Okay? If you read the book of Proverbs against that backdrop, Proverbs 1 through 9 is all about its instruction to these young men about how to behave, and it's got a ton of stuff about speech and about proper sexual conduct. Okay? And so one of the arguments is that Solomon may have implemented in ancient Israel something akin to that. Now, the final footnote is the wisdom literature, when you read it, it's going to be quite different because in contrast to a lot of the rest of the Old Testament where, you know, you're reading and you keep hearing about the Exodus or about the period in the desert or about the entrance into the land or about the kings and all these kinds of things, the wisdom material talks virtually not at all about any of the great historical traditions of ancient Israel. And so what holds it together is creation. You really see the majesty and wonder of God in creation. Okay, let's. We'll go through this pretty quickly. Again, one of the things that's pretty fascinating is that how wisdom often, in the narrative anyway, in the career of David, falls into... comes from women. This one is pretty fascinating. If you know the story, this is Absalom has ousted David from Jerusalem, and he gets two of David's advisors, Ahithophel and Hushai. Ahithophel was considered the top advisor, and he tells Absalom, "You got him on the run. Go for the kill," which is right. David was very vulnerable. Hushai says is a double agent and says he's for David. Says this time Ahithophel's not right. If you miss on this one, it's bad news. And we are told that Hushai's advice was taken because God had determined to undo the advice of Ahithophel. So it shows wisdom ultimately is not, you know, doesn't have kind of saving power, if you will. Again, a wise woman at Abel. Solomon manifests all the different types of wisdom. If you remember the first one, again, this one's pretty familiar. This is when he has that dream. What's really significant, though, is he says, "I want wisdom so that I can be a benefit or a blessing to the people." Okay? Then this is the splitting of the babies, where he really shows kind of the practical, the ability, applied knowledge. This is the one about all the proverbs and everything. This is not uncommon, in ancient Egypt or Mesopotamia, that wise people ordered things. They're called onomastica. They're like taxonomies. You know, how do you line up all the trees, all the plants? And then you can make a very good case. The reason the Queen of Sheba comes to visit Solomon is because she is doing a ton of international trade from the east with Egypt. Israel was the land bridge in the ancient world. And her caravaneers are now coming back and saying, "It's a new day. There's some guy taxing us coming and going." And she makes a trip, I think, to see if this guy has enough clout and power to back his taxation. And when she comes and sees how impressive he is, she decides, "We will pay taxes." So it's very practical kind of administrative stuff. Okay, this one's where I want to end. And this may be the one that's less familiar to you. Again, remember, wisdom has two forms, the positive or the practical, and the negative or the reflective. So I'll put these up here, and then I'm going to tell you a few stories. So let's start with the positive or pragmatic. One of the things we have a number of treatises in ancient Egypt, and the form that they always take is a father giving instruction to a son. Sometimes the father is seen as the king who's on his way out and giving advice to the prince on his way in, but it also can be just advice from an official to a lower official or lower. Okay. In fact, originally, the earlier ones tend to be more circling around royalty, and then we even know that moment where they begin to take more of what we would call middle-class values, minor officials, sort of for everybody. Again, that's the material I was talking about. These are incredibly helpful because they're giving advice to young men primarily about how to behave, how to live, how to understand the way the world works. Okay? And they show a lot of really incredible values, how you speak, you know, those kinds of things, how you conduct yourself, how do you respond to people. If we have time, I'll read you a couple. But again, they're really fascinating kind of stuff. And they reflect a particular culture and world. But clearly, they're part of the educational system. Sometimes they're a little tough to read because most of the copies that we have are copies that were made by these young men. You know, one of the things they did in the scribal schools was they copied this stuff down. And so you hope the one that survives in the desert sand is from an A student, not a D student, or the spelling's a little tricky. But the others are scribal literature. So the satire on the trades. One of the challenging things to do is to keep these young guys in school because they're not generating income in school, okay? So the satire on the trades is this really fun document where they go through in this document and every occupation is critiqued. So you think you want to be a jeweler, and then it'll give the reason why that's a crummy job. You don't want to be a jeweler because you sit hunched down all day, you look at really small stuff, and you find your eyesight goes pretty quickly. You think you want to own a laundromat. You do not. You don't want to own a laundromat because laundry is done at the banks of the Nile River, and guess who hangs out at the banks of the Nile? Crocodiles. Okay? You think you want to be a contractor. You do not want to be a contractor because you spend your day knee-deep in mud. Okay? It goes through every single occupation. You want to be an embalmer. Well, you can imagine why you don't want to be an embalmer. Okay? The one occupation that's the coolest occupation in the world is to be a scribe. And again, it shows really fascinating values. The reason you want to be a scribe is because you get to live in cool cities. You need to live where people need reading and writing, like Washington, D.C. You get to hang around important people. But again, it's a document that really functions to keep these guys motivated. While they're copying it down through dictation, they're being told, this is why education is so valuable. Reading and writing will take you anywhere you want to go. Okay, the tale of the eloquent peasant, this may be my favorite. So, again, you're trying to convince these young guys that knowing how to speak is really significant. Here's the backdrop. There's a family that lives out in the country, and things are really bad, and they're about to go bankrupt, and so they've sold about everything they have, but they take their final possessions, and the father loads them on the wagon, and he heads to town to sell them. Okay? As he's almost about to come into town, there's a bridge, but just in front of the bridge, there's a minor official who lives on one side of the road, but he owns the land on both sides. And the road is flooded. This minor official, what he does is floods the road, and so when the peasant comes, he has to go off the road into the field to get around to get on the bridge. When he goes around the flooded section of the road, the official comes out and arrests him for trespassing and confiscates all his stuff. Okay, it's quite a racket. Now, the peasant has lost all his stuff. He has no power. He's an outsider. I mean, he's the quintessential, you don't have a chance. But he decides to take the minor official to court, and the minor official is the best friend of the magistrate. Okay, so here comes, the peasant doesn't know that, and he steps into court, and the magistrate wants him to lay out his case, and the peasant lays it out, and the magistrate says, you know, the peasant lays it out, and apparently the peasant is incredibly articulate, he is eloquent. And the magistrate says, well, I can't make a decision today, but come back tomorrow and we'll talk more about this. And the magistrate then goes to the king and says, you won't believe, I've got this guy that's just incredibly eloquent. And the king says, well, defer your decision, I'd like to hear him. And so each day, it becomes kind of a thousand and one nights, but each day, the magistrate brings the peasant back to present his case, just because he likes listening to him, okay? Boy, you can imagine after 5 or 6 days, the peasant says, you know, I've spun this case every which way I can. You've got to make a decision. And the magistrate says, oh, I decided for you on the first day, but you were so enjoyable to listen to, I just kept bringing you back. Now, the question is, you know, why would that function in a scribal school? Because you're convincing these young guys when they go out and engage in diplomacy, it doesn't matter what the odds are, the great equalizer is the ability to speak and articulate your position. The last one, the beautiful man with his bob. This is more the negative or reflective. So your ba is, it's not your soul, but it's kind of your inner being. It's what lives on after you die, if you have a shot at living on in Egypt, okay, depending on where you fall. Well, this guy, it's really a difficult text, but I'll give you my spin on it. So this guy, his life is miserable, and so he starts out loud thinking, I wish I were dead. He's not contemplating suicide. He just wishes death would come to him, and his ba gets angered at how this guy is grumping and grousing and everything. And so his ba decides to respond and says, knock it off, enjoy life, you know, quit being such a grump. And the guy gets into a discussion or a dialogue with his inner being, with his ba, about the value of this life versus the next life, or versus, you know, death versus life. And everything that the guy says, you know, my life is miserable because, you know, I mean, what do you want to pick? I lost my job today. And the boss says, yeah, but, you know, who knows? Maybe tomorrow you get a better job, or, you know, this happened. Ah, but tomorrow you may have this. Okay? Ultimately, though, it comes down to, at the end, I think, the guy says, this life is so miserable, I'd just like to move on and go to the next life. And the boss says, well, you know, as miserable as this life may appear, at least it's known. The next life is unknown. And what if you get there and find out it's worse than this life? You can't kick it into reverse. Okay? Now, again, that's a very interesting worldview. That the present, the known, even if it's miserable, is preferable to the unknown. Think about people you know that, you know, they may hate their job, but they're not about to go look for another job because, what if I found something worse? Or, you know, I hate this, but, you know, that kind of thing. That's what's going on there. Okay, out of Mesopotamia. And then we'll be done. You have similar material, the Councils of Wisdom. These are a series of pieces of advice, and they're really fascinating. Again, they show cultural values. They talk a lot about how young men should engage women, or how to think about women. One that's kind of fun is, to show how, you know, you can see these themes. The one is, don't confide in your wife or anyone else. Confide in your mother, because your mother has your best interests more at heart than your wife does. Well, that's kind of interesting. But if you think about it, if you know Proverbs, at the end of Proverbs, there's words of the mother of Lemuel, and she's got, interestingly, as a woman, she's got a less than healthy view of women. But you have these kinds of things, you know. And again, they go back and forth about how you think about work. Lots of information about, or lots of talk about laziness, about the virtue of hard work, these kinds of things. But that's the Councils of Wisdom. Ahikar is a famous text. Ahikar was a sage who gave advice to the king, and he fell into, the king didn't like the stuff he was telling him. And so he kind of falls on the outs, and in fact, the king, when he really gets hacked off, threatens to have Ahikar killed. But one of Ahikar's closest buddies, who's also a courtier for the king, hides him. So there's quite a bit of risk going on here. And after Ahikar is gone for a while, the king realizes how badly things are going without the advice he used to get from Ahikar. And he says, I wish I hadn't had this guy killed. And the courtier, his buddy, says, well, his chance would have it, you know, back. And again, it shows the value, you know, this kind of thing. We have proverbial collections, the Odyssey literature, A Man and His God. This is the closest. You don't get anything really quite like Job. There's nothing quite like Job in the world. In fact, in Mesopotamia, when trouble falls on you, you do not do what Job does. You do not tell God what you really think. What you do is offer lots of praise to the gods, because they tend to be fickle, and they tend to love to hear praise. And so you just flatter them incessantly, and then they'll do good stuff for you. It's a very different worldview. And then we'll end with, I don't think I have it. Yeah, one of my favorites is called The Dialogue of Pessimism. Again, it's a fun one. It's a master and his servant, and the master is saying, you know, I think I'm going to go on a ride today. I'm going to go hunting. And the servant says, go, let's go, because there's nothing better than killing and capturing a game, okay? And then the guy says, no, I don't think I'll go. And the servant says, yeah, let's not go. What if it backfired and the lion jumped us or whatever, okay? And then he says, I think I'm going to do X. And the servant always has to come up with a good reason why that's a good idea. And then the master immediately reverses course and goes, no, 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 bad idea. Okay, the best one though is at the very end, the guy says, yeah, this life is really tough. I just think I'll kill both of us and we'll check out and be done with it and move on. And the servant says, okay, good idea. We'll head for the next life. It's going to be fun. And then the master says, no, I think I'll just kill you and stick around here, okay? And the servant, this is cool, the servant says, not a good idea. You wouldn't last 3 days without me. Okay, that's